Today, reading the economic tea leaves. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I want to go through some of the things that I've been thinking about with regard to the old thorny question of inflation or deflation and touch on a few of the issues that I think should be on the table. Now, I have to tell you that this post is not necessarily going to end with a definitive position, but I want to underscore some of the critical questions that I'm thinking about at the moment and that you might want to think about too. There are lots of different models out there for how the economy works, right? And I guess the neoliberal view is that the economy is fundamentally powered by debt, and the more debt we can push into the system, that inflates asset prices, that creates greater GDP activity, and that has what's been happening for the last 20 to 30 years in particular, right? And so, you know, the theory goes, well, you basically take deposits, those deposits get lent on, that creates momentum in the market, though that can then be lent out, etc. That's the classic model. Now, in fact, that's wrong on a few perspectives in my view, but the most critical one is that actually lending comes first. So essentially, if you look carefully, what's happened is that lending has created pretty much all of the growth, economically speaking, around the world, and banks can continue to write as much lending as there is demand for lending to be had, right? So that's sort of the basic philosophy. And basically, what that says is, for as long as credit growth continues to rise, that will then lead to more GDP, more economic activity, and therefore overall growth. Now, that is, if you like, the classic model. That's the one that most people in the mainstream would probably hold to. And therefore, the way to actually get more growth is to reduce interest rates so that it makes it easier and more attractive for people to basically borrow. And that can be people, can be businesses, as well as individuals and corporates. So you drag rates down, that creates more momentum, and that will then create more activity, and that will lift GDP. So that's the fundamental economic. Now, of course, you get to the point where you can take rates down so far, and then essentially you get to the point where you have to take them into negative territory if you want to continue that trajectory, because we are close to zero, right? So the economic growth that we've had over the last 30 years in Australia is fundamentally about taking rates lower, driving more debt, and that's why particularly household debt is way higher than it was. So that's the classic model. Now, in that environment, what it basically says is, okay, if you then start creating ever more liquidity in the marketplace, and that liquidity can come simply from banks writing more credit, or it can come from the concept of essentially the central banks then starting to, you know, just create more money. That's the old money printing QE thing, right? Put that money into the system. That then produces more activity. The risk is that activity ultimately then starts to devalue the value of money. And the risk then is that you have to try and tackle two issues off the back of that. The first issue is you could end up with effectively international investors losing faith and trust in the Australian economy, which means that they will be less willing to invest unless you start increasing rates again. Right. And the second is that in the sort of the fiat theory of money, you devalue the value of money. So effectively, the numbers get bigger, but the value doesn't necessarily go up. And that's where you get the inflation theory. So basically, what it says is if you continue to flood money into the system and more money of that money is lent, that creates more activity, sure, but then you risk inflation. And of course, that was the model that was happening in the 70s when, of course, we had the oil shock and we had high interest rates. So that's the sort of the theory. So most people, I think, in the mainstream would say, right, in that environment, what you do is you protect yourself with assets that don't get inflated away, like precious metals or other things like that, right? And so therefore gold becomes a hedge. And many of the large players, I mean, Ray Dalio is a good example, right, basically is an advocate of gold. And even, Warren Buffett has actually invested in gold, not directly in gold, he's actually invested in gold miners. So that's the sort of the classic view. And there are many people out there who believe that the future is inflationary. So that's where you start the conversation. But my view is I'm not sure that that's necessarily that convincing. Right, because we have had lower interest rates than we've ever had. And if you look at the economies around the world that have actually followed this track, and I'm thinking here of Japan, who's been at it for 30-odd years now, or the Eurozone, they've taken rates lower. And in fact, the exact opposite is happening. So rather than inflationary effects coming through, we're starting to see deflationary effects. In other words, we should be clear about definitions here. What is deflation? So you can define deflation or inflation looking at CPI. Well, CPI probably gives you a bit of a myopic view of what's going on. You can look at it in terms of money supply, and there are people who hold that the way to define inflation is purely growth in money supply. Well, the money supply in Australia grew 11% over the last year. In the US, it's more than 20%. But that doesn't necessarily, in my view, lead to real inflation, all the things I've just been talking about. And in fact, the alternative theory is, as you take interest rates down, there is a limit to the impact that that actually has. And if you don't get demand for more lending to come through, then essentially you have the start of an issue, because you get deflation rather than inflation more likely to happen. And if you actually have people repaying debt rather than taking more debt out, in other words, if the rate of credit growth declines, that is then deflationary, that sucks effectively value out of the system, and that can then become a reinforcing downward cycle. And so as you move interest rates lower, rather than interest rates leading to inflation, in this theory of the world, it can lead to deflation. And the point there is that once that starts to grind through, it's very, very hard to turn it around. Japan is the best example. The Eurozone is the best example. The Eurozone has taken interest rates into negative territory, as has Japan, and yet there is no sign of inflation. Now, that's the sort of the dilemma that you face. So who's right? Well, if you are a gold bug, and if you are somebody who's in the asset industry, you will want inflation, because that creates significant momentum, etc., etc. So there are lots of advocates of that model and recommendations off the back of it. If you are a deflationary holder, then you've got a different view, because basically in the deflationary world, the chances are is that even gold is going to not necessarily gain in value. The stock markets will probably slide backwards, and the chances of getting growth in the traditional sense is very low. So we get into a stagflationary, deflationary cycle. And that's the dilemma. I'm on the fence. I don't know which way this is going to go, but I am less convinced, compared with many people, that actually the future is naturally inflationary. And therefore, I've tended to be more cautious than some investors who are basically piling into inflation-protecting assets. I'm preferring to sort of say, not sure yet. Let's see how it plays out. Central banks have been very bad at actually bringing inflation in. As you know, the inflation metrics at the moment are very low. And even with the Fed saying they want to, you know, allow inflation to come over the barrier a little bit to counteract the really low momentum they've had in the last few years, they can say that. But if their strategy is continue just to sort of put more liquidity into the system, and if there's no demand for that liquidity, then it may flow to asset inflation. So we might see stock markets rise a little ahead. But ultimately, that's not going to drive momentum in the real economy. If you have lack of momentum in the real economy, then this whole thing turns around. So in a nutshell, that's the dilemma that I think we face. And I'm not sure that we know which way this is going to evolve. All I'm saying to people is you want to be careful betting everything on an inflationary future when the leading indicators so far, those have been at it the longest, which is Japan and the Eurozone, have created deflation despite doing all the things that we talk about. Now, then the next thing, just to sort of complete the picture, and this is Steve Van Meter's point, if you look carefully at the US situation, the banks essentially are swapping assets. So what they're doing is basically, if you think of the structure of their balance sheets, they're actually moving more of the Fed debt onto their balance sheets, and you know that process is continuing. So that supports their structural integrity from a capital perspective. But they are actually repaying other. So the net growth isn't. It's an asset transfer, and that's Steve's critical point, right? It's really an asset transfer rather than purely creating new money out of nowhere. We've created more money, right? Now, the question is, where does that money go to? If you don't actually enable it ultimately to flow into the banking system, and if the banks aren't able to lend it because there's nobody actually wanting to borrow more loans, then that ain't going to work. So therefore, the government might throw it into helicopter money, right? It might throw it into infrastructure spending, all of those things. But those activities aren't necessarily inflationary. So the question is, what do you do with the money, right? And you know, the MMT guys, who are also now, you know, we should think about those. The MMT guys say, well, interest rates are really, really low. They're going to stay low for probably forever. That means that you can actually, you know, lift the government debt. And the fact of the matter is that if rates stay low, then the governments can service it. But then the question is, yeah, but what do you do with the money, right? Do you actually productively invest it? Do you actually create momentum in the economy? Or, as the bank, as the government here is, I think, doing, just basically throwing a bit of money around the place and hoping somehow that the private sector is going to pick it up and run with it, right? All of the evidence is that corporates are buying back shares by issuing those bonds and buying those bonds and essentially, artificially lifting their share prices, despite the fact that the performance of those businesses are pretty low at the moment. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, if you look at consumers around the world, it's true in the US, it's true here, they're paying down debt rather than actually taking more debt out. I mean, in Australia, the total credit growth is around 2% and, you know, it's falling slightly, despite the fact all this everyone's talking about first-time buyers being controlled back into the market and et cetera, et cetera. So the question becomes, where does the money go, right? That's the critical question. And the point there is that there is an argument to say, at some point, if international investors in particular lose faith in what the government is doing, then they will not invest unless interest rates go up. And of course, if interest rates go up, then the cost of that debt starts to accelerate dramatically, right? And on the other hand, I guess there's an argument to say if you can get inflation, then the idea is that you can actually effectively, in real terms, deflate the total balances outstanding. And of course, there are arguments that that's what they're trying to do. The question is, can they do it? And there's no evidence around the world that they've been successful in doing it. My argument is, if you actually are unsuccessful in, you know, creating the momentum in the economy, because the economy is significantly broken, and I think that many of those government investments are actually money throwing, you know, bad money after bad money. A lot of the JobKeeper went to corporates who should never have got it in the first place. A lot of small businesses never got any of it, and they're the ones really struggling. About one third of SMEs in my surveys are actually likely to fail in the next year or so. I mean, there are so many, you know, leading indicators of negativity in the economy, but they're going to go on doing that. So they will, the 1.1 trillion, well, that's going to be definitely exceeded. It'll be a lot more than that before we finish. But unless they change their tune in terms of where they put that money, it doesn't necessarily create the momentum in the economy. And I just come back to this worrying statistic, right? Although they're these first-time buyers have been taking first-time buyer loans and trying to buy it into the property market, the mortgages of existing loans is being paid down faster. So net, the overall loan pool is going down. That's deflationary, right? The banks will not be able to loosen lending standards too much because of they've got to sort of, you know, bear in mind there are still risks, and the risks actually in the economy are very high. I've been speaking to a number of bankers who are very concerned about the risks in their portfolios now. We're going to see probably more bad news down the track. There is no certain path here of the government and the Treasury and the Reserve Bank together being able to create an inflation wave, a momentum of economic recovery wave. And if they're not successful in doing that, then the only other option is, you know, grinding on or grinding down. And remember this, China has now started turning the, you know, the volume up in terms of turning off various, you know, exports from Australia. Iron ore looks to be the latest. BHP confirmed that the other day. So our trade situation is going to deteriorate. We've been a one-trick pony there. That's another risk. And the final point I'd make is that this is not something which is just happening here, but it's happening, of course, in a lot of other countries too, in terms of this same central bank nuttiness of continuing to try and do more and more and more of the same thing, only bigger, right? Now, the problem is, if you look at it actually, you know, from a modeling perspective, you have to actually do not a linear increase, but a logarithmic increase in the amount of injection of liquidity that you need to just stand still. So the problem is that at some point, that, you know, this can't go on for, this can't go indefinitely. It'll have probably gone for a lot longer than people think, right? I mean, think about the $4 trillion that the US has put in. You know, that's what the Fed's done, plus everything else. But it's not actually turning the economy around. And so my argument is this is fundamentally broken. The property market is the key to understand, right? And this is actually the point, right? Because we know that household debt to income ratios are very, very high. We've got some of the highest ratios in the world. Debt to GDP for households is also very high. And it's all to do with housing. 65% of bank lending is housing related, plus another 10% for construction related. So three quarters of banking is actually in the housing and construction sector. That's a huge deal, right? The problem is that we are not getting anything like the amount of investment in productive businesses and innovative businesses and creating more value. All we're doing is basically inflating house prices because of this debt multiplier that I've mentioned earlier on. The fact is that banks can continue to lend for as long as people actually want to borrow. Now, then therefore it comes back to a question of confidence and a question of whether the banks are willing and able to borrow. Well, the Reserve Bank has made it absolutely clear by manipulating the yield curve and providing direct liquidity infusions into the banks that the banks have more than enough money to lend. There is not a supply side problem in Australia in terms of banks and their ability to lend, and structurally they are actually pretty sound, so there's no issue why they couldn't lend. But they have to, you need demand, right? And demand comes from a few different sources. Property investor sector was a very significant driver of property for quite some time, but they have actually basically stepped on the sidelines now because rental streams are actually decreasing rather than increasing for many, and the capital appreciation that we had has pretty much stopped in many places. Now, there are a few exceptions, but if you look at the standard high-rise unit property investor, they're losing money from the capital and also on a income basis. And in fact, there's about more than half of property investors are in negative returns at the moment. So that sector's gone away. We've also got no international investment now for property in Australia. Chinese basically said, no, don't do that. There is evidence that a number of foreign buyers who committed off the plan and paid their 10% aren't wanted to complete. They just disappear. Very hard to do anything about that. And we also know that migration is going to be negative. So overall supply demand means we have less demand for property than ever we've had. We think that the net oversupply of property is now about 1.2 million properties across Australia, and that's continuing to increase. There's no reason why prices would rise. So the only thing that can make prices rise is if the debt machine can be pumped again. Now, that's why first-time buyer incentives are there on the table. That's why home builders there on the table to try and actually suck people into the Ponzi scheme to keep the whole of the property sector going. The question is, how long will that be able to survive? Bearing in mind, we have a lot of people still paying down mortgages. We've got property investors, as I said, on one side. We've got some up traders who are interested in buying bigger property. But if they believe that property prices are going to slide rather than rise, they're going to wait. And then you've got what I call down traders. These are people sitting in larger properties with equity. And they're now getting to the point of thinking, gee, well, actually, if prices aren't going to continue to rise, maybe I should get out now. And that will be probably more supply coming on next year. So the supply-demand disequilibrium that I see is flying in the face of all of the incentives, all of the drivers to try and actually support the banks and support the housing and finance sector. I don't know which is going to win. I just know that this is a really interesting tug of war. But I have a nasty suspicion, bearing in mind that prices are 40% over long-term trends relative to all the metrics that I look at. At some point, this is going to come back. And it's a question, I think, of whether it's going to come back slowly, whether it's going to come back quickly. The banks obviously are desperate to lend more. They're chopping their rates to minimum to try and actually encourage new people to come in. They are looking to reduce the lending standards further. But of course, in a higher unemployment environment, they've still got to have those risks in mind. Remember that we've got some people now returning their repayments to normal status, but about half haven't yet. And unfortunately, quite a few of those, I think, are unlikely to do that. So you've got this real complex situation. I have the view still that over the next 2 or 3 years, prices will be lower than they are today, but the government will do absolutely everything and will throw, you know, lots of liquidity, lots of money at the property sector and the banks to try and support it, because if it fell, it would be the biggest crunch ever. And that's the dilemma that I see. My own view is I think stocks are overvalued. They will come back because the fundamentals have to come back at some point. But that may take a bit of time. I did an interview with Harry Dent, in fact, yesterday, which is quite a long, ranty interview from him. But he made a wonderful set of points about the fact that stock markets will come back at some point. He's got this 90-year cycle, and he thinks that you know, the end of this year, beginning of next year is when that hits. So we'll see. So at the moment, over the next little while, I still think some of the bonds are actually where the opportunity is, because I think that things will continue the way they are going for some long time. And obviously the price of bonds move accordingly. The story with regard to property investment is I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole at the moment. I think that the likelihood is that people are going to get significantly burnt. All my surveys are showing lots of property investors are now really struggling. About 25% are underwater, and the number who are looking to sell over the next few months are quite strong. But the point you've got to ask yourself is this going to be a long, slow grind, all right? Or is it going to be effectively bubbling up to a significant reset inflection point, right? And do you therefore prepare for the other side of that inflection point when, in fact, values get reset? And it's a bit like the 1929, 31 window, where effectively a lot of people lost their shirts, but other people who could see a bit more prepared beforehand waited for the fall and then basically reinvested at that point, you know, the Kennedys being a good example. So what I'm trying to do is position ahead of the fall, which I think is coming, but not yet place too many bets, because I actually think that the timing is not clear. Neither is the trajectory completely clear, but I'm just not convinced enough of hyperinflation coming in, or even very strong inflation coming in within the sort of time horizon that many people and many experts and many people on YouTube are all talking about. I just don't see it. I just think the central bank strategies have been fundamentally flawed over the last 20 to 30 years. They're repeating the same mistakes again, only more so. And they're expecting a different result. And I frankly don't see why that would be the case. I think we're going to see the same cycle of more infusion of liquidity into the system. I expect the quantitative easing and the jawboning in particular will go up even to fever pitch and beyond. I mean, the Fed at the moment is spending more time trying to talk the markets in a particular direction rather than doing much, which is interesting. And a bit the same now in Australia. I think they're out of ammo, and I think they're out of strategy. And what I suspect will happen is they'll have to actually break the mold and think more unconventionally, whether that's a digital currency of some sort or whether it's deeply negative interest rates or something like that, which they'll probably try. But I'm not sure that it will necessarily actually take it to where people expect to take it to be. And if, in fact, we don't get inflation, then a lot of the investment strategies that people are holding at the moment are actually going to look very, very bad down the track. So all I'm saying is at least consider the alternatives, right? At least understand that there is potentially an inflationary future, but there is also a deflationary future. And therefore, because the signs are so conflicting and it could go one of two ways, just be a bit cautious. Don't put all your eggs in the inflationary basket, assuming that somehow this is all going to, you know, work out. And I've also made the other point. This government debt that we've got, this massive amount of government debt, will have to be paid back ultimately in some way at some time in the future. And that is a deeply deflationary force later, right? So whatever we do in the short term, we've still got that debt bomb to come later. So I just can't get away from understanding the quantum of the debt we've got, which is growing, the lack of momentum in terms of economic growth, which is definitely still stagnant, and the levers that the central banks are pulling don't seem to me to be connected to much. We know that people are consuming less rather than more at the moment. If you look at the consumption numbers, they're way down. The GDP, of course, is half related to consumer consumption. That's significantly down. Now, there are some consumers who are still consuming well. They've still got jobs and they're doing fine. But what I'm concerned about is the larger proportion of the population who are under deep financial pressure are finding that their jobs are now part-time jobs. They're getting paid less. There's no income growth. Even the Reserve Bank is saying that income was going to be pretty static over the next 3 years. And for many people, there's been no income growth since 2010, right? Just bear that in mind. So a lot of people are under deep financial pressure, and therefore their ability to consume is crippled, all right? So that's the first point. So overall demand, I think, will be less rather than more ahead. The second point, if you look at it in inflation-adjusted terms, the public sector has seen a small increase. The private sector has seen a decrease. But there are more people in the private sector than the public sector. So overall, net income growth has been static since about 2012, right? So that means that people have less money available, but they also have more debt. Now, what's happening at the moment is that the average repayments on loans that people have are roughly in line where they were back in 2010, 2011, when interest rates were a lot higher and when effectively income had been growing. But they're still committed to that chunk of debt. But many people now, because of the fact that they've got less income coming in, are having to actually borrow more, look at Afterpay, look at some of the other quasi-financial products that are all going quite hot at the moment. That's because people are struggling to maintain their lifestyles. The third point to make is what's different now is we're starting to see what I call structural unemployment. So the first wave post-COVID were part-time workers and gig workers all being laid off, right? But now I'm seeing middle managers and above in large companies suddenly being asked to leave because basically companies are having to right size. And that has only just started. Consulting started very early. Financial services are doing some stuff. Other sectors are following too. As you may know, retail has had a real issue as well. So there are many more people now out of work. And a lot of the out of work people now have been on big incomes and were the very people who were consuming a lot. So I am a little bit less certain of the ability of household sectors to consume more ahead. And if that is true, goes back to my deflation, inflation story, right? Because if it is true, then effectively that momentum that you're talking about may not be there. Bear in mind also, of course, that the dollar is now up at, 71, 72? And that has an impact in terms of prices of imports versus exports. That may have a negative impact too. We might actually end up being importing deflation rather than inflation, right? Because people were thinking the dollar was going to be about 50. So I'm not necessarily seeing the conditions where you actually have more spending power and therefore you can drive prices up. And in fact, if you talk to most retailers, they're having to eat margin at the moment, maybe other than office furniture and, those doing remote communications setups and things like that. The only other point I'd make is that, interestingly, the construction sector are now paying their workers less, but they're actually having to pay more for all the materials to actually build the houses that we don't need anymore, right? So what we're seeing there is that the mix of costs in a construction job is changing. And productivity more broadly is probably one of the most critical things to talk about, right? Our productivity stinks, right? We have gone backwards, and frankly, there's no processes there to turn it around. All the argument about, the technology will, enable us to be more effective and productive, it's proved not to be true. And so productivity, innovation, new businesses investing in new things, all very, very much on the back burner at the moment. I'm speaking to a number of small businesses who can't get funding, who can't actually get the help to innovate and create new businesses currently now. So the small business sector is definitely cooked, in my view. The large business community, right? Okay, well, the financial services sector we know are being very much compressed, despite the fact they're being given all this liquidity. And, you know, I'd argue a lot of the budget was about bank saving rather than anything else, frankly. But, you know, that's then you've got the resource sector. Well, you know, the BHP story from yesterday, which is that they've confirmed that China's turned off some of their demand for iron ore. That's a big move, right? So we've got the China factor going on there. We've got the COVID thing, which is still raging. The international borders are unlikely to open anytime soon. That means that we're not going to get a lot of tourism coming back to Australia. That means that a lot of international students won't come back. So you can look at big sectors of the economy and you can understand why they potentially will be under pressure. So my question is, where is that countervailing force that's going to create the momentum to allow people to consume more to create the inflation? I just can't see it. This isn't going to necessarily, you know, blow up this October. I mean, I'm not sure Harry's right in terms of his timing. We shall see. Could well. But this could go on for quite some time. The central banks will go on doing what they're currently doing. But, you know, the definition of insanity is to do the same thing again, only more so, and expect a different outcome, right? The central banking philosophy that is driving this at the moment is bankrupt, in my view. It's not going to get us to where we need to get to, right? But unless we can actually change that philosophy, we're going to go on through this process for quite a lot longer. And it's interesting that there were some reports out of Europe that said, you realize that banks, basically, as interest rates come down, get less profit, so they actually struggle to be able to maintain themselves. They tend to take higher, more speculative risks rather than lending, because essentially the only way is to trade stuff, to try and actually make some returns. They can't take deposit rates below a certain level because people just take the money out of the banking system, and that then creates a bigger problem. And it's very hard to turn the whole process around. So once rates are very low, they tend to get stuck there, because there's no way back. And that's my real big concern, that this central bank strategy and these very low rates take us to a cul-de-sac, and I can't see a way out of the cul-de-sac at the moment. And that's why I'm sort of sitting where I'm sitting, saying this ain't working, it ain't gonna work. The future is obviously quite concerning. It might be inflationary, but I have a feeling it's more likely to be deflationary. And there is a significant risk of a financial correction through this process. If you look at the rate of credit growth, it's declining. So you have to look at two things. You have to look at the Reserve Bank credit aggregates that comes out each month, and that's broken down by different categories. And then you need to look at the new loans, which are committed loans, which the ABS publish a few days later. That's commitments. That's not the same as drawn down loans. Right. So what RBA reports and what APRA reports is the total gross balances for housing and for business held by the banking system. Right. The new committed facilities, which is going up for first time buyers and, you know, new construction, doesn't tell you about loan repayments. It doesn't tell you about the refinanced situation. So you have to look at that. And then you also have to look at the APRA statistics that gives us the loans that are actually not currently being repaid. And those have come down a little bit on repayment holidays. About half are coming back, according to the ABA today. But we know that there's a sort of a crunch coming for a number of people whose income has dissipated and are now unable, basically, to make those loan repayments again. So that's the other factor. So you've got to understand housing in the context of debt. You can't, you know, separate the two. Because this debt engine is broken, and I think it's unlikely that we're going to see massive expansion of debt anytime soon, that's another deflationary force that I come back to. So there you have it. I'm afraid that we are in a complex situation with lots of variables. I think that those who actually are claiming to know precisely how this is going to play out are probably confused and myopic. There are too many variables, too many uncertainties. So be cautious and be careful at the moment. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.